You're tuned to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. This week, flaming faggotry. Just in time for an antidote to Valentine's Day hype and all the gay marriage news we've had this week, we'll hear from the editor and two contributors to the new queer anti-assimilationist anthology, Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots? Flaming Challenges to Masculinity, Objectification, and the Desire to Conform. Matilda Bernstein Sycamore is back for a third visit with us. Last time she read from her novel, So Many Ways to Sleep Badly, a stream of consciousness romp through the sleep-deprived life of a tenderloin sex worker that pokes fun at NPR, Bikram Yoga, and the travesties of post-gay San Francisco. Soon after that appearance, she moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico. She's back here for a week or two trying to drum up sales for Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots, her fifth anthology. If you can't hear, you can take off your headphones. When I have a little problem here in the studio. Previous anthologies include Nobody Passes, Rejecting the Rules of Gender and Conformity, and That's Revolting, Queer Strategies for Resisting Assimilation. So you might, as you might guess, she has a contrarian view of marriage and establishment gays. Described by the Austin Chronicle as a cross between Tinkerbell and a honky Malcolm X with a queer agenda, Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Matilda has brought with her a contributor to Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots, a Spice Girls fan since middle school. His essay is called I'll Tell You What I Want, What I Really, Really Want, Homo Love and Accountability, which he wrote under his boy name, Harris Kornstein. You might know him better, though, by his drag name, Little Miss Hot Mess, who has appeared all over San Francisco. This past holiday season, he was in Drag Queens on Ice at the Union Square Ice Rink, apparently the only one who actually knows how to figure skate. And he's a regular at Tranny Shack, The Stud. I should say she is a regular at Tranny Shack, The Stud, and Hard French. Harris Kornstein, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thank you very much.
So I think, Harris, I'd like to actually start with you reading a bit of your essay from Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots? And the essay is called I'll Tell You What I Want, What I Really, Really Want, Homo Love and Accountability.
All righty.
Take it away.
I'm lying on my back in my best friend Jeff's room. He's sitting on my chest, legs resting on either side of my small but chubby torso. He pins my arms above my head with one hand, leaving his other hand free for gentle slapping and rough poking. He's always been stronger than me. Then again, maybe I'm not resisting. Maybe I want my hands to stay put, in a pose that indulges both an attitude of damsel in distress and acquiescence. My fingers swim through the tan carpet, grabbing shag that's caught too much dirt over the years, making it rough and clumpy. It reminds me of my grandma's rug, only hers is older and clumpier. This one somehow doesn't fit in Jeffrey's otherwise white and sterile suburban home. Jeffrey puts his hand over my mouth and playfully tells me, just breathe through your nose. Next, he grabs my wrist and uses it to slap me in the face, taunting, why are you hitting yourself? When I pretend I'm mad at him later, he tells me all I had to do is ask him to please stop. Jeffrey's not a bully. He's my best friend. We're 10 years old. Jeffrey and I eventually become a trio with the inclusion of Brad, a short kid who liked to draw and shared our interest in things related to magic and other worlds. Looking back, we were from day one something of a ragamuffin posse of baby fags. A tap dancer, Jeffrey, an illustrator, Brad, and a figure skater, me, who artfully dodged the expectations of grade school masculinity by choosing arts over sports and closeness over competition. Our friendship was solidified in riding the bus to Hebrew school once a week. We were all in the same class, a treat that never happened in day school. We created an identity for our trio by combining parts of our last names and kept journals and sketchbooks where we wrote down jokes copied from TV and practiced drawing cartoon characters. We would beg our parents to let us have sleepovers with all three of us, sometimes even two nights in a row. We spent hours inventing superheroes, creating trading cards and spellbooks, and acting out games we invented, borrowing characters and scenarios from our favorite modes of fiction. Each of us chose a preferred niche or persona in a given narrative, a magical power, a favorite video game fighter, or a character from The Wizard of Oz. As high school drew nearer, we started learning what it meant to be popular and found ourselves making new friendships that sometimes gelled but often didn't. We bought new clothes at the approved stores in the mall, watched Dawson's Creek, and started caring about what kind of music we listened to. Hello, Third Eye Blind, and goodbye to the Spice Girls. It was also the time for dates and friendships with girls, which meant sitting next to your girlfriend at lunch, which wasn't hard since we generally ate at the girls' table anyway, calling her on the phone and stepping awkwardly together at school dances. Another friend of ours invited us to sleepovers where we'd try to make out the scrambled images on the porn channels, pretending to see the things others couldn't. But growing up and trying to be popular also meant keeping secrets from and inventing things about one another as we aspired to perform the related modes of popularity and straight masculinity. Brad and I started referring to Jeff as Stacy behind his back, an attempt to emasculate him, and Brad reported finding gay porn on Jeff's computer. That was the first instance, in any context, that the term gay surfaced within our once tight circle. There's a part of me that's shocked by how easily we learn to throw around words like gay and fag, attempting to hurt and discredit the others without tarnishing or implicating ourselves. While this is clearly how teenage straight masculinity is performed, I'm not sure how we thought we could get away with it when we were each failing in almost every way. We weren't friends with the popular kids who called us all fags, and we didn't really want to be. Yet we still started rumors and tried to build strategic alliances in the halls of middle school. Why did we turn against each other, and what were we afraid of when it came to our relationships? Homophobia, external or internalized, is an easy answer, but one that feels too superficial and dissatisfying. Writing it off as childish doesn't seem to be useful either. It may be silly and moot to expect my 14-year-old self to have acted more responsibly, but there's a part of me that can't help romanticizing this moment as a potential time for rebellion, that knows it could have all been different if we had been able to draw strength from each other rather than trying to win the usual games that we were already set up to lose.
That's Harris Kornstein reading from I'll Tell You What I Want, What I Really, Really Want, Homo Love and Accountability. It's from the book Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots? Flaming Challenges to Masculinity, Objectification, and the Desire to Conform, edited by Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, who is also here in the studio with us. Harris, what were you trying to, you know, get at or work out with that essay?
Yeah, I mean, I was really trying to unpack my relationship with two of my earliest friends who happened to also be gay, and to sort of think through what it meant to grow up with these two queer friends and to sort of remain in the closet to each other until relatively later in life, when we sort of had these pseudo-sexual but not completely sexual relationships as smaller children.
Mm-hmm.
And to sort of think through what that meant in terms of how we as queer men and gay men relate to each other as we get older and the ways that we trust or don't trust each other and sort of the ways we learn to communicate with each other.
And you came out of these three friends, you came out first, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as I remember reading the essay, you signed one of your emails to Jeff later as Homo Love instead of, you know, Love Harris,
right.
Homo Love Harris. And that kind of provoked some reaction from him. What was that about, and how did that prompt him to finally, you know, fess up to you?
Right. Well, he thought that I was sort of trying to drag him out of the closet by saying homo lover, that I was implying something about his sexuality. And really, at the time, I think I was just trying to be provocative to everybody and to sort of push people's buttons a little bit.
Did you think he was gay or kind of know he was? Or,
you know, I had my suspicions. But, you know, I was willing to take him at face value and go with his story at the moment. But that it was actually kind of nice because it actually prompted this conversation, not only in which he came out to me, but also in which we got to talk through, like, is this actually a homophobic thing to say? Can you be gay and still say things that are homophobic or negative towards the queer community? So,
Like calling each other faggot, for example, or using that word.
Well, faggot, I think, is a beautiful world. word and world.
It is a beautiful world.
So, I mean, I think gay, you know, the way it's been used, it's all about normalcy at any cost, you know? So it's about what you buy, where you shop, you know, maybe who you have choose to have sex with behind closed doors. But by using the word faggot, I want to invoke a more radical, transformative history, you know, of deviant freaks and queens and outsiders who reject the status quo and want to create something, you know, more defiant, more deviant, more flamboyant, and to challenge, you know, the assimilationist norms of a corporate cozy lifestyle, not just buy into, you know, the latest gimmick, you know, whether it's Absolute Vodka or Diesel Jeans, the things we're told that, you know, this is what it means to be gay, right? We can have a rainbow Hummer now, you know.
So is it a rejection of being marketed to so heavily? Is that or a rejection of the, I don't know, mentality that we have to be accepted by mainstream society, money will bring us our rights?
Exactly, rejection of both of those things. So one, the marketing, you know, the gay consumerism has, you know, become the ultimate target market. And I think the gay establishment really buys into that wholesale. You know, it says, if we just buy the right things, then, you know, suddenly we'll be accepted. You know, maybe we'll even be better, you know. And So gay culture is so much about policing the borders and keeping out the wrong type of people, including other queers, whether that be homeless youth or, you know, older queers or fat queers or queers of color. It's all about policing the borders instead of expanding the borders and encouraging fluidity and experimentation and the original values of gay liberation, you know, which was like an end to, you know, marriage, an end to U.S. militarism, an end to organized religion. So I want to sort of get back to that sort of flamboyance and, you know, deviant challenge to the status quo.
Do you think you're kind of unusual in that, you know, in your generation? Let's say, I don't know how exactly how old you are, but I'm guessing you're about 10 years younger than me, and maybe Harris is about 20 years younger than me. Since when I was listening to the Spice Girls, I was already way out of graduate school, and you were in junior high. but, I mean, does it seem like there's less of that... revolutionary is not exactly the word. Revolting. Less revolting among the younger generation than there is among, you know, folks my age who maybe went through the AIDS crisis in the 80s and so on.
Well, I think unfortunately, there's less revolting among everyone. You know, and I think in San Francisco, I think there was a really dramatic shift with the whole gay marriage hoopla engineered by Gavin Newsom. I think at that moment in San Francisco, I remember seeing, you know, people who had never had any interest in marriage suddenly lining up at City Hall, you know, at all hours of the day and night, you know, toasting each other with egg salad and wine. And I think, you know, there's so much emphasis on gentrification and consumerism and, you know, buying into the establishment, you know, becoming part of the power structure. You know, San Francisco is that place where gay people have succeeded at becoming part of the power structure. And so what do we see now? You know, we see, you know, gay bar owners having homeless queers arrested because they're getting in the way of happy hour, you know. And with this book, you know, I want to sort of examine the hypocrisies of gay sexual and social culture. So I want to go into the intimate level of how, you know, people treat one another and how sex has become something that's regimented and divisive. And, you know, like, if, for example, I think the best example is to talk about sort of internet cruising, you know, norms. And I think if you look, you know, at any cruising site, at the end of every post is something that they want to exclude. So whether it's no femmes or fatties, whether it's straight acting only, you know, whether it's no blacks or Asians, you know, these are just normalized, you know, and no one challenges those kinds of norms. And I think if we think about it, the irony of a gay cruising site where everyone signs their post straight acting only.
do you find that is a predominant way that people sign off there? I don't
absolutely.
Believe it or not, I don't go to gay cruising sites. I just don't. I don't know. Never got into the computer thing. You know, I have to do it for work or whatever, but, you know, I don't hook up online. I don't, what is it called? PNP? Yeah.
Right. Well, PNP is a great
party
example.
And play, folks.
I mean, only gay culture would make party and play mean close the door, lock the doors, you know, close the blinds, and make sure that no one can glimpse our degradation, right? So that's what party and play means. I mean, let's get back to actually, you know,
playing,
freaking
outside.
Out and having fun, you know, and expanding, you know, our visions of desire and intimacy and love, creating ways of, you know, loving and lusting for and taking care of one another that are outside, you know, of the sanctioning of whether it's state or, you know, normalized family or whether it's organized religion or whether it's just some tacky new, you know, consumer trend.
So you've been working on this book for quite a while in a way, because you had a public event about 5 years ago. I looked back through my emails and realized that you had an event called Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots? Maybe 2006?
Yeah, it's true.
Right.
I started, actually, it was a performance series that I did a few times in the Queer Arts Festival. And I invited people, you know, to perform, you know, in response to that question, why are faggots so afraid of faggots? So that wasn't exactly the genesis of the book, but it was certainly the genesis of the idea.
Mm-hmm. And Harris, why did you submit an essay, and what inspired you or intrigued you about this? First of all, I just want to say there's 30 essays in this book. And can you give just a little snippet of the a flavor of the diversity of things that are covered, topics.
Absolutely. I mean, there's such a wide range, and that was one of the things that was so exciting to me in putting the book together. So, for example, the first piece in the book by D. Travers Scott, he talks about reimagining the web outside of masculinist either-or limitations. So he talks about creating a faggoty web. You know, we have a piece by Debanuj Dasgupta who talks about everything from growing up in Kolkata, India, and as a sort of English-educated, kind of globe-trotting, you know, middle-class gay man, and really looking down at, you know, feminine coties in the park, and then was harassed in the park, you know, by the cops when distributing condoms, and it was the coties who came to his defense. So he sort of talks about transnationally, you know, how queers and genderqueers and trans femmes find one another and create community and culture outside of straight and gay norms.
Could you explain what coties is?
Yeah, coties is just a term in India. Sometimes it's referred to as third sex, third gender. So it's, you know, feminine, queenie, male, you know, male socialized people who, you know, are not English. You generally are not English educated.
Okay.
But, I mean, there's also a lot of pieces that talk about the AIDS crisis and talk about how, ask the question whether risk reduction, you know, in trying to stay safer, whether people have actually rejected risk and limited the possibilities, you know, for queer interaction. There's a lot of pieces about online cruising, sort of interrogating all the different kinds of hierarchies, whether it be about race or body type or class or, you know, all the things. There's two pieces about prison, one by someone who was in prison, and then one by a straight female prison guard talking about, you know, homophobic prison norms. Hmm. So there's a really wide range. You know, people are talking about childhood. People are looking back over several generations. Tommy Avokoli Mecca talks about cruising the streets in 1970s Philadelphia. You know, there's a lot of pieces about, you know, like complicated sexual interactions, whether they be one-night stands or cruising parks or back rooms or long-term relationships.
You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. My guests are Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, editor of Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots, an anthology of 30 essays challenging the gay establishment, I guess you could say, and questioning the way we act. And one of the contributors to that anthology, writer Harris Kornstein, whose alter ego is Lil Miss Hot Mess. So, Harris, I was just about to ask you, what inspired you to submit an essay to this book?
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was an incredibly provocative question. And as someone who never quite fit into the gay or straight world, as someone who was always sort of femme, sort of a sissy, sort of a little bit genderqueer, as a drag queen, I guess I did want to interrogate, you know, what in our histories, what in our culture and the ways that we interact with each other really prevents us from connecting with one another. And I had actually just worked on a short film about these two friends that I talk about in my essay, and so this was sort of another way to explore that same relationship.
So I'm curious to know how you, first of all, how long have you been a drag queen, and why, and how did you pick your persona, Lil Miss Hot Mess?
Well, I've been a drag queen for 4 years, although I will say that it's probably the thing that I've always wanted to do with my life as a, you know, 3-4-year-old, I remember.
Now you're in San Francisco.
And now here I am. It's pretty easy, yeah. But I mean, I was always a cross-dressing, performing child. And so it was sort of the natural outcome of that. And my persona, I mean, my persona, it's just a different side of myself. I like to say that I earned the name Little Miss Hot Mess. It was not something that I chose, but I like to use it now as ways to expose the ways in which everything and everyone around me is really the hot mess.
So I'm curious to know from both of you how drag queens have changed over the years. It used to be sort of a very, you know, there's a sort of a more acceptable way of drag queens. The older standards of Donna Sachet comes to mind, for example, and it seems like it's that concept is being messed with a little bit more. And also, there's, I think, been a tradition of some women being offended by drag queens. Like, why would you want to just act like a woman in a very hyper-stereotyped sort of a way? And not, you know, let your feminine side out more on a daily basis. Harris.
Yeah. Well, I will not name names. I will say that. But I do think that there are the sort of pretty pageant queens, out there in San Francisco, and especially more throughout the U.S., I think, you know, there's queens in every city and small town across the United States. But I think that there's also always sort of been this trajectory of the more political drag queens, the drag queens who use the performance not just to feel pretty or to imitate or to put on a show, but also to question gender, to question racial politics, to question, you know, national politics or economic policy or things like that. And I think in San Francisco, we're really lucky to have a lot of queens who are doing that, and who are often doing it at the same time as they're looking gorgeous and, you know, have these incredible looks and performances. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't see it as so much of a move away as sort of different streams of drag that that really are all sort of about artifice as a way of undoing artifice, and artifice as a way of sort of challenging what our dominant assumptions and ideologies are.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, Tommy Evacoli Mecca, in his piece in the book, actually sort of talks about doing radical drag, is the term he uses, in the 1970s, you know, and existing sort of outside of the categories, conventional categories of male and female, and just throwing it all in the trash, you know, with flair, of course.
So let's switch topics just a little bit. By the way, I just want to say I wasn't trying to wasn't trying to cast aspersions on Donna Sachet. I think she's great and has done many wonderful things for her community, and I applaud her.
Although her politics are a bit reactionary, I must say.
I don't know. I haven't had a political discussion with her, but I hope to have her on out in the Bay sometime soon. So now, this week, we've had this marriage news, and aren't you just thrilled to pieces about it?
Well, Harris gave me a platinum ring in the car. I mean, you can't see it on the radio, but it's big,
it's
and it does say
big,
Tiffany
yeah.
all over.
Yeah. Straight from Africa.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Diamonds, yeah. I love those blood-soaked South African diamonds.
So seriously, is there any? Do you see any? What do you see any bright sides in, you know, in the California the appeals court, and also it's couched in, oh, an early Valentine's Day present for the gay and lesbian community. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has struck down Proposition 8 as unconstitutional in Washington State. Now, is there good stuff in here?
Well, a better early Valentine's Day present would be this book, Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots? And, you know, we are having a Valentine's Day launch even, you know, at the San Francisco Main Library at 6 p.m. on Valentine's Day. So if you want to get someone something they can actually appreciate, not just some tired rock, you know, something they can read and learn from and, you know, expand their possibilities, their sexual, social, political possibilities, that's what I would recommend.
Harris. Yeah, I'm going to go with no comment on this one about marriage. I think I'll let Matilda do the heavy lifting here.
You are your own PR agent. You do well at it.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, yeah. It's time to throw marriage in the trash. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Not rely on some, like, outdated, hideous institution to, you know, give us any sort of validation. You know what I mean? I mean, marriage, last time I checked, it's still a central institution of anti-woman, anti-child, anti-queer, and anti-trans violence. So we shouldn't be fighting for inclusion within such a tacky, outdated institution. I mean, even most straight people know marriage is hideous. You know what I mean? So why are gay people propping up this failed institution instead of doing what we do best, which is to create radical alternatives to the status quo? You know, I mean, I think gay and queer people have been creating fascinating and transgressive and transformative and really successful ways of building family and love and intimacy that aren't defined, you know, by the state or dominant institutions.
And do you find it harder to keep on doing that when same-sex marriage it comes closer and closer to being legal in more and more states? I mean, I remember in 2008 when it was, you know, that window. It seemed like there was more of a, okay, now, you know, if I don't have a boyfriend right now, or if I don't have somebody who could prospectively be a partner, or if I just don't want to get married, even if I do have somebody, now I'm a third-class citizen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Did you find a lot of that happening? Did you sense that feeling at all, either of you? Harris?
Well, I think that's the problem with the gay marriage movement. You know what I mean? It's fighting for the rights only of people who are willing to conform, you know, to this heteronormative, you know, institution in order, you know, they want the state to sanction our carnal coupling, right? So it's like, well, if you get married, you can have health care, or you can have housing, or you have the right to stay in this country or leave if you want to. but not everyone else. You know, what we need to be fighting for is universal access to basic needs. So things like housing and health care and the right to stay in this country or leave if you want to, food, you know, love, a good sex life. These are things that everyone should have, not just married people.
Dope. I'm not even going to go there, but let me ask you to, you have another short section you're going to read from a different essay, right?
Sure, yeah. I was thinking I would read a little bit from a piece by C.A. Conrad, who's on the East Coast in Philadelphia. And the piece is called Going from Zero to Sexy on High Caloric Queer Overdrive. And I'm going to read from towards the beginning. This is C.A. Conrad. When I was recently invited by a queer student group to give a reading at their college, it was faggots who got angry at me after I read from my book, Deviant Propulsion. One young man angrily confronted me. The things you write are not making room for discussion or acceptance. My parents love and accept me, but they would never accept the things you write in your book. How weird to be in this position, I thought, but decided to say what I felt was best. First of all, your parents should love and accept you, so stop giving them brownie points for something they should do. Second, this is your world, too. Stop walking on eggshells and take up some space. And not only that, but do you realize you're asking me to write different books for the love of your parents? You need to get off of that right away and get crazy and open to the possibilities of your life. When I was 20, everybody hated us. And in many ways, I can look back on that now and realize how great it was for me. Never once have I written a poem or anything else with the love and acceptance from others in mind. My writing is mine and has always been mine. Society's hatred has kept me true to my creative punch. But how do I get young faggots to realize that this time of assimilation means that we need to become even angrier and more rebellious and creative so we can change the grim, apathetic direction in which we're all headed? So much attention and so many resources now go towards creating a pro-gay military, and this has brought us a horrifying sense that we need to serve, we need to sacrifice in order to be loved and accepted. Forget all that. Being queer in this brutally homophobic world is more than enough sacrifice. And with the pro-gay military also comes the ever-streamlined pro-military gay body, worked on obsessively, a machine for the common good of the state. It's never been more unacceptable to be fat, and no one knows this more than fat faggots like me. Being fat these days is not just unacceptable because it's unappealing and gross to mainstream society, but it's also now seen as contrary to the very movement for acceptance. The mainstream war machine regiments our appearances, actions, and lives. Fat bodies do not fit into military issue battle fatigues. An old friend asked me once, doesn't it disturb you that men only want to be with you because you're fat? No, I love it. How about your boyfriend? Would he like it if you got fat? No, he would leave me. Oh, I see. Doesn't it disturb you that he only wants to be with you because you're skinny?
Thank you so much. That's Matthew. Ah, I did it. Matilda Bernstein Sycamore reading from Why Are Faggots So Afraid of
and
Faggots.
And I was reading a piece by C.A. Conrad.
Thank you.
I was channeling Philadelphia, C.A. Conrad.
Thank you for doing that. The book reading, we've got to be kind of fast here, but the book launch next Tuesday, Valentine's Day, at the San Francisco Main Library. Is it in the Jim Hormel Center, Gay Lesbian Center? Do you know where it is?
No, it's downstairs in the Hispanic Latino room, and that's 100 Larkin Street.
Yep.
That's on Valentine's Day, this coming Tuesday.
6 o'clock, and then City Lights Bookstore on Wednesday, the GLBT History Museum next Thursday, Pegasus Books the following Monday. And where can people, is our place, your website?
Yeah, they can go to my website, MatildaBernsteinSycamore.com.
MatildaBernsteinSycamore.com.
Yeah, if you search Matilda, M-A-T-T-I-L-D-A, it'll be the first thing that comes up. And Harris designed my beautiful site.
I did.
And Harris's website, Lil Miss Hot Mess, is Lil Miss Hot Mess, L-I-L, Miss Hot Mess. WYRFaggots.com. I want to thank my guests, Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, editor of Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots? Flaming Challenges to Masculinity, Objectification, and the Desire to Conform. And one of the contributors to the anthology, writer Harris Kornstein, whose alter ego is Lil Miss Hot Miss.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Out in the Bay on KALW.org worldwide, 91.7 FM in the Bay Area, or maybe on your mobile phone via Stitcher or via podcasts. The Stitcher app and podcasts are free on our website, outinthebay.com. I want to thank KLW for studio use and airtime, and thanks tonight to our engineer, Joanne Marr. We'd love to hear from you with your questions, comments, and guest suggestions, so email us, eric@outinthebay.com and marilyn@outinthebay.com. I'm Eric Jansen, and I am out of here.